to explain the parasha of B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven from two perspectives, or two different parts of it. First, what exactly went on over here, because there's a lot of questions. Let me read you a few of the psukim and we'll see what the problems are. Torah says, Umikne Rav Hoyo Livnei Reuven Livnei Gad Atzum Me'od. B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven had a tremendous amount of cattle. Vayiru es Eretz Yazer ve'Eretz Gilad v'hinei amakom makom mikneh. And they saw the area that had been conquered now from Sichon and Og in Eiver HaYarden, in Transjordan, the other side of the Yarden. And this was a tremendous pasture land. Vayavol b'nai Gad v'nei Reuven vayomer Moshe v'Elazar ha'kohen v'anisehu ha'idelimor. They gathered together Moshe and Elazar and the Nisiyim, and they presented their case. What did they say? Ataros, the Divon, the Yazir, the Nimra, the Cheshbon, the Elole, Uslam, Unavo, Ubaon. Said a bunch of names. End of the sentence. Next sentence. Ha'oretz asher hiko Hashem lefnei adas Yisrael eretz miknehi v'lavodecho mikneh. End of paragraph. This is the land that HaKadosh Baruch Hu let us conquer from Sichon and Og, and it's pasture land, and we have a lot of cattle. Period. Don't ask a word. First they say a bunch of cities. Then they say, these are pasture land, we have cattle. And the end of the paragraph. So, when there's a paragraph, that means that's it. They stop. New paragraph. Vayomru, they said, now something new. Imotsanu chein beinecha. If we found favor in your eyes, let this land be given to your servants as an inheritance. Don't take us over the Yarden with you. So another question over here is, so far they said three sentences. The first one was just a bunch of names. The second one, they were more clear that these places are pasture land and we have cattle. Then they stopped talking, end of paragraph, and all of a sudden now they ask what they wanted to ask. But they don't say, Yitain, give us this land. They said, Yutan, let it be given, in a very passive way. Not, you give it to us, but let it be given. From who? Who's going to give it? So now, Vayomer Moshe Livnei Gad V'nei Reuven, Ha'acheichem Yovel Milchom V'yatzem Teshvu Po. You want your brothers to go into war on the other side of the Yarden to conquer the seven nations, and you're going to sit here in peace? V'lom Asiniyun Islei B'nei Yisrael Me'avor La'aretz Asher Nasal Hashem. You are going to turn the hearts of the Jewish people away from Hashem, because you're going to say, see, they're afraid to go, and they're going to get afraid too. Koasu Avosechem, you're the same thing as what happened with the Meraglim. B'sholchi Osomi Kodesh Barnea, Liros Es Haaretz. Vayalu Ad Nachal Eshkol, Vayiru Es Haaretz, Vayanu Es Lei B'nei Yisrael, Vilti Bo El Haaretz, Asher Nosol Am Hashem. They also weakened the hearts, turned away the hearts of the Jewish people, and scared them, and made them cowards, and afraid to go and conquer Eretz Yisrael. Vayicharaf Hashem, Vayomahu Vayishova, and you know what the consequences were. Hashem got angry, and he said, he made a shvua, Miru Anoshim Olim Mitzrayim, Ben Esrishon of Amala, Esadoma, Asher Mishbati, Lavrom Yisrael Yaakov, Kilo Milu Acharai, Bilti Kolei, Ben Yifuna, Hazkizi, Vyoshua, Benun, Kimulu Acharai Hashem. And no one's left from that generation, except for Yoshua and Kaleb. So what happened, because they were afraid to go and conquer Eretz Israel, and they made everybody else afraid. For that reason, we were wandering the desert for 40 years. Atom kol ador ha'usa rabin Hashem. Until that whole generation died out. And you're repeating the same sin. Let's boast old al charon af Hashem Yisrael. You're going to make more anger. We're going to stay in the midbar another 40 years. So Moshe Rabbeinu really gives it them. They answer, "Vayikshu elav, vayomru gidro sol nivne lemekneinu pal v'orim letapeinu." Look, we'll make a compromise. We'll build cities here for our sheep and for our children, and we will go. We're not going to stay here, right, and make people think we're cowards. No. Anachnu necholei tzchushim lifnei b'nei Yisrael. We won't only accompany them, we'll go first. We'll be the pioneers. will be the chalutzin, the ones who go before the whole army, will be on the front. Until they conquer that part of Eretz Yisrael, the Eretz Yisrael proper, and divide it up, the Yoshav Tapenu Biore Anivsur Mitnei Yoshvei Haaretz, and our children and wives will stay here in fortified cities, so they're not attacked by the people who still live in this side of the Yarden. Lo Nashuv El Batenu, and we won't come back to our homes. Adish Nachel Bnei till until all the land is given out, is divided. And settled. All we want is a portion here and not there, because this is good pasture land. And Moshe Rabbeinu agrees to that. And he even makes it easier for them. He says, you don't have to wait till they divide up the land. All you have to wait is till they conquer. It took 7 years to conquer and 7 years to divide up. You just only have to stay there 7 years of the conquering. You can go back before they divide it up. That's the parsha. A few questions. First question is, if they have a request, say a request. Don't say a bunch of cities. Then say, well, you know, we have pasture, and this is good, we have cattle, this is good pasture land, and don't ask anything, and then that's the end of the paragraph, and then only after that make your request. Why don't they make the request to begin with? Secondly, there's a halacha that I'm sure Moshe Rabbeinu knew, that don the kafskos, give people the benefit of the doubt. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu jump down their throat? Why didn't he assume that they didn't want to stay there? They were going to go and conquer Eretz Yisrael. Why did he assume that their intentions were bad? Maybe their intentions were good. Maybe they just wanted pasture land. They weren't intending to stay here. Why didn't he ask them, do you mean you're going to stay here? Why did he right away castigate them and give it to them, right? There's a mitzvah, don the kafskos, give them the benefit of the doubt. And if already didn't give them the benefit of that, and that wasn't their intention to begin with, so why didn't they stop them in the middle? Moshe got it all wrong. Don't jump to conclusions. We don't need to stay here. We're going to go. And there was a nice vort from the what's it called, Chedushi Arim? Was it Chedushi Arim? Or the Imre? One of the Ger Rebbe's when he was a boy. So he stayed up all night with the Chavrusa, and they davened Kivasikin. And then they went to sleep, and he didn't show up at Shachris because he already davened Shachris. So later on, his grandfather, right, came to him and said, "How come we didn't come to Shachris?" And started giving him Musar. And he didn't correct him and say, "I davened Shachris kivasikin because I stayed up all night, listen to the Musar, whatever." So they asked him, "Why didn't you tell him that he's off base? That the Musar is misplaced? You davened kivasikin." He said, "I missed the chance to hear some Musar from my grandfather." It's the same thing over here. B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven knew that Moshe Rabbeinu was off base, but they wanted to listen to the Shmuz, the Musar Shmuz, right? We're stopping in the middle and lose that chance? I have a different answer. We'll get to it in a second. So that's another question. Why didn't they stop him? Why didn't they say right away, "Moshe, no, you misunderstood. You're jumping to conclusions. That's not our intention." And if Moshe really suspected that that was their intention, that they're cowards, then why did he agree to this setup where they'll leave their wives and children and cattle on this side of the Yarden and they'll go to fight? One of the main things the Meraglim said is, "We're not afraid of our lives. We'll die. But Nashenu v'tapenu yiyu labaz. Our wives and our children are being killed. We're more concerned about our wives and children than us. Okay, if it was just us, so we'll go and fight. And if we get killed, we get killed. But what's going to be with our poor wives and children?" So now you're letting them keep their wives and children on this side of the Yarden in relative safety. They're going to fight. But why don't the people say, "Hey, that's not fair. Their wives and children are safe. And they're putting their lives in danger. But people are more concerned about what happens to their wives and children than themselves." So why was that a acceptable, the plan? Moshe said no. Moshe should have said no. People are going to say you're a bunch of cowards. That's why you're putting your wives and children in safety, and their wives and children have to be in danger by crossing over the Yarden. You let your wives and children come with you, and then we'll see. Then you'll fight. You'll put your wives and children in danger, and then you'll go back. Therefore, I think that this parasha, from here we learn a halacha. It says, Moshe Rabbeinu after that said to him that, okay, if you'll do that, and you'll go and fight, right? And you won't go back until they conquer Eretz Yisrael, then fine. V'yisa nikiyim me'ashem u'mi'Yisrael. Then you'll be clean in the eyes of God and the eyes of the people. Okay. We learned a halacha from this. V'yisa nikiyim me'ashem u'mi'Yisrael. That a person cannot only worry about God, how God sees things, but he has to worry how people see it too. The whole concept of marasayim. Right? It looks bad. Even if you're not doing anything wrong, 100% you're doing something right, but it looks bad in the eyes of people, so you're not allowed to do that. Okay? That is a halacha, the yisam, the kiyam, Hashem Yisrael. You can't even give people a chance to be choshed you, even though there's a mitzvah for people to be done the katzchos, to give you the benefit of the doubt, not to be choshed b'ksherim, not to suspect innocent people wrongly, but there's a mitzvah on the person who's doing it not to give the other person a chance to, what's it called, to suspect him wrongly or not to give him the benefit of the doubt. Everybody has their Torah, right? The Meir Shapiro, the Bnei Narod, said, it says in Tehillim, uvesoraso yege yomim v'layla. A person should busy himself with his Torah day and night. What do you mean, his Torah? She says in every relationship there's two Torahs. Everybody has his Torah. And everybody has to worry about their Torah, not the other one's Torah. I'll give an example. You have a person who loans money to somebody and the other person borrows the money. So you have the Lova and the Malva. Okay? The Torah says to the Lova, you better scrimp and save and pay this man back on time, right? And be great, gracious to him, have some gratitude to him or whatever. The Torah says to the Malva, you better not pressure this guy to pay you back, if you know that he can't. You better not take ribbis from him, right? Don't take any ribbis, right? Give it to him without him giving you anything in return. Okay? Don't pressure him. Don't take ribbis. Each one has their Torah. So if the Malva says, you know what, I better be careful not pressure him. I'm not going to take any ribbis from him. I'm loaning him the money with a good heart. And the Lova says, I better scrimp and save and pay this guy back, and I better show him some gratitude, what's it called, that I appreciate that he gave me the money, as long as it's not ribbis kind of gratitude, then shalom al Yisrael. Everybody's fine. But you know what the problem is? When everybody keeps the other guy's Torah. The Lova says, you better not pressure me, and you better not take any interest from me, right? And the Malva says, you better scrimp and save and pay me back on time and have some gratitude. Then there's problems. So everybody has to keep their Torah. Same thing over here. I have a chiyuv, right, not to suspect you wrongly and to give you the benefit of the doubt. You have a chiyuv to function in a way that you don't give me reason to suspect you wrongly or not to give you the benefit of the doubt. Why is that? For a few reasons. Why is it important not only to do what's right, but to do what's right in the eyes of people too? Even if you're 100% doing this right, don't do something that people could suspect you wrongly. There's a few reasons why. Give you some examples where this halacha is. The Kohen who went in to count the money that was given to Bedek HaBayis, right? The monies for sacrifices, the shkolim, that had to go count, couldn't wear a beged that had a seam or had pockets. That nobody should think that he pocketed any of the money. There are no pockets. You can't pocket anything. There's not even a seam in the beged. There's no place to hide it. Okay? Now, did anybody really suspect that the Kohanim are going to pocket a few shkolim? But you have to be above suspicion. Don't give people a chance to suspect you. Now, why? One reason is that you're over lifnei iver. Since I have a chiyuv not to suspect you wrongly and to judge you favorably, if you do something suspicious, right, you're putting a stumbling block in front of me and making it easier for me to be over the issue of suspecting you wrongly and not giving you the benefit of the doubt. So even though I have my mitzvah to not suspect you and to give you the benefit of the doubt, you have a mitzvah not to put me in a situation where I'm tempted not to do that. That's lifnei iver. That's one reason. Second reason. Because if you suspect me wrongly, right, of doing something wrong, then you could think that, well, look, he's a frum guy, so if he can do it, probably it's okay to do. That's what Marisayim. If I see somebody doing something that looks like he did something on Shabbos wrong, for instance, I see somebody hanging up a wet beged right, from that got wet in the rain, and I see him hanging it up on the clothesline. So I might think he washed his beged. I might think it's okay to wash clothing on Shabbos, because I don't know it got wet in the rain. I see it's a wet beged. He's hanging it up where you normally hang it up. It looks like he just did the laundry. So you're not allowed to do that. It's marasai, right? Because people will suspect. So what difference does it make? Because somebody will say, well, this guy's a frum guy, and he hang up his laundry on Shabbos. Obviously, there's some way of doing laundry on Shabbos. So I may learn from him what to do wrong. There's a second reason, though. And that is, even if I won't learn from him, I'll know what's wrong. But the fact that I see people doing wrong things affects me negatively. Meaning the following. The Ma'aril Diskin says, we normally think that giving people the benefit of the doubt is for their sake. Right? Don't jump to conclusions. Don't judge people, what's it called, critically. Give them the benefit of the doubt. And that way you're nice to the other person. He says, no, it's for your sake. Why? Because people are influenced by their surroundings. And if I live in a place where everybody's Mechal Shabbos, I'm not going to have a deterrent for me not to be not so careful with Shabbos. I may not be Mechal Shabbos, but I'm not going to be extra Machmir in Shabbos because everybody around me are a bunch of Mechal Shabbos. Right? They don't care. So I have no incentive to be extra careful with Shabbos. But if I live in a place where everybody are Talmid HaChamim and they all baki in Hilchot Shabbos and they all keep Shabbos meticulously, the peer pressure of the environment is going to make me more careful with Shabbos. So if I look around me and everybody's no good, this guy I suspect of doing this thing wrong, and this one I suspect of doing this thing wrong, and I don't give them the benefit of the doubt, then I'm surrounding myself in my mind with bad people, with people who are sinners. So I'm going to take away a deterrent from me and an incentive from me to be extra good, because the people around me are bad. At least I'm better than them. But if I always give people the benefit of the doubt and I look at them as tzaddikim, then I have the peer pressure and the deterrent and the incentive to also want to be a tzaddik, because I'm embarrassed to do things in front of these good people. But if I look at them, all of them as bad people, then I take my own incentive and deterrent away from me. So for those three reasons, there is a mitzvah of not, what's it called, not giving people a chance to suspect you. Not doing something suspicious. Do it in a way that you're not only good in God's eyes, you're good in people's eyes too. That's what we learn from this parsha. Therefore I want to say, that was the whole parsha. They understood this and Moshe understood this, and this is what was going on. A discussion whether what they're doing is going to be suspicious or not. They came and they understood. If we come out right away and say, you know, we'd like to stay over here on this side of the Yarden because we have a lot of cattle and this is good pasture land, people are right away going to be suspicious that that is just an excuse and they want to stay here because they want to be safe. Okay? And they are going to do something that is suspicious. It looks pretty bad. Therefore, they didn't come and say to Moshe Rabbeinu, we'd like to stay on this side of the Yarden. They came and gave a hint. First, the hint was extremely subtle. They said to Moshe Rabbeinu, listen to all these places. All they did is mention a whole pasuk of places. Moshe says, okay, these are places. Moshe knew what they're getting at. All these places have something in common. They're all good pasture land, and they have cattle. Moshe Rabbeinu was not a dummy. Moshe Rabbeinu could put things together and right away say, I get it. You're trying to tell me these are good pasture lands, and you have cattle, and you want to ask me to give you this as your portion. Then Moshe would have suggested it, not them. There'd be less suspicion. Then people wouldn't say, well, they're cowards and they want to stay here. It was offered to them by Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, not that he didn't take the hint, but he didn't take them up on the hint, because Moshe held that even if he suggests it, but they came, people are going to still be suspicious. So then they went one step further. Moshe's not getting the hint. So they said, okay, we'll make it a little bit more clearer. These lands are all good pasture lands, and we have cattle. Right? Now, therefore, now Moshe, now you got it. We don't have to be so subtle. We're a little bit more clear. So tell us, we'll give it this land. Moshe still doesn't get it. Not that he doesn't get it, but he still understands that if he does offer them that, it's going to look suspicious. So they stop. They stop after that, hoping Moshe Rabbeinu is going to get the hint and offer them the land. Moshe doesn't say a thing. Then they finally say, okay, we'll come out and say what we want. We want, not you should give us this, let the land be given to us in a very nebulous way. Again, being very careful that maybe if we ask you to give it to us, then people will say we're cowards and we want to stay here. But if the land will be given somehow, indirectly, then maybe people won't be suspicious. Moshe Rabbeinu said, good try, but none of this is going to work. You know how it looks in the eyes of the people? That you are continuing the Chet HaMeraglim. Moshe knew, and they knew, that Moshe didn't really suspect them. Moshe knew that that's not what they meant. But Moshe said, doesn't make a difference what I think. People are not going to think like that. People are going to think what I'm saying. Therefore, he wasn't really castigating them for what he really believed. He didn't judge them unfavorably. He knew that that's what they meant. But that's not how it looks. And I'm telling you how people will see it. And therefore, they didn't stop him. Because they understood also, it's not that Moshe is trying to tell us that this is what we really think, but this is how it looks. And we can't stop him because it's true, that's how it looks. So they said, okay, how about if, since the only thing over here is appearances, you don't really suspect that we are cowards. You knew that, what's it called, that we intended to fight if we had to. We're not looking to get out of fighting. So what if we go and fight, we'll leave our children and wives here, will that be enough to take away the suspicion? If Moshe Rabbeinu really thought that they were cowards, then this wouldn't help. Because if you're cowards, then leaving your wife and children here isn't going to help anything, because maybe you're more concerned about your wife and children than yourselves, just like the Meraglim were. But if it really, I know that that's not your intention. It's only to fix up how it looks in the eyes of people. This is enough to take away the chashad. People then will give you the benefit of the doubt. They won't say that, well, you don't care if you die, but your wives and children are safe. They'll say if they're going already and they're putting their lives in danger, probably their intentions are okay. So since the whole thing over here was only appearances, no one really thought that they really thought this. And they knew that Moshe didn't suspect them. But they knew that Moshe Rabbeinu was telling them how it appeared and how other people would see it. So then all the questions are answered. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't jump to conclusions and he didn't judge them not favorably. He just said, this is the way people are going to see it. And you have a chiyuv to make it look good in the eyes of people too. Like we explained, you can't give people reason to suspect you wrongly. And therefore Moshe accepted this compromise because that's enough to take away appearances. It wasn't enough to take away if they really were cowards. But if it's only appearances, this is enough. People will not jump to conclusions. They'll give you the benefit of the doubt if you go and fight. Even if you're leaving your wives and children, they won't say, well, they don't care about themselves. But they care. They'll say, you know what? It's not really that they're cowards. They really want this pasture land. And they're going and willing to fight, be in front of the people. That's good enough. That is the parish. In my estimation, that answers a lot of questions, and that explains the main thing that we learn from this parasha is that pasuk, v'yisem nekiyam me'ashem Yisrael. We should learn that from another pasuk also, v'nimtza chein v'seichel tov b'nei Elokim v'adam. It's not only in negative things, but even positive. Positive things should be done in a way that not only God sees it as good, but people also see it as good. As it says in Pirkei Avos, Eze derech yishore sheyavr lo ha'adam. What is a straight path that people call shitiferes lo seho, that's glorious to God, but also glorious to people. People should also see. Not only they shouldn't see negative, but you should do it in such a way that God sees it as positive and people see it as positive too. Not just they don't see it as negative. So that is the whole parasha, and since the whole parasha revolves around that, it explains all the questions that we asked. Yeah.
How does caring more for your wife and your child make you a coward? Do you spend that money?
Yeah. Sometimes people, right, say, you know, I don't care what happens to me, but my poor children, my poor wife, right? So the Meraglim said, right, you know, look, we're not scared for ourselves. We're not, you know, so selfish that we're not going to go fight in Eretz Yisrael, whatever. But what of our poor children, wives and children? They said that. Mashenu v'tapenu yiyu levaz. Our children, our wives are going to be a hefker. They're going to be captured and plundered by these goyim. Right? How can we stand by idly for that? You know, we could be brave and be willing to fight to the death, but what's going to happen to our wives and children? We can be brave on their expense. So that's what the Meraglim said. So here, if they say, you know what, we'll go fight, leave our wives and children safely on this side. If Moshe really suspected that they were cowards, right, and then how is that going to help? The Jewish people say, hey, these guys' wives and children are okay. Okay, they're going to fight, but what about their wives and children? Our wives and children are in danger. But if they really didn't suspect them, it's only appearances. And it was only to take away somebody giving them not the benefit of the doubt. This is enough. If they're going to go fight, right, the fact that they're leaving their wives and children, I'm not going to already jump to conclusions and say that you're doing it because you're cowards. I'd say, you know what, it's probably true. You're doing it because you want the pasture land. Because if you were really cowards, you want to stay there also. That's all. Yeah. The what?
The
Nimtzachein, yeah. Right. The Nimtzachein, the Seichel Tov, Beinei Elokim, the Adam. In the eyes of God and people. Even though in the eyes of God it's 100%, you have to also have in the eyes of people. Yeah.
Why is it any better looking in the eyes of people if the tribe itself asks to have their wife and children sit behind them and go fight, as opposed to Moshe taking the earlier hint and saying, okay, your wives and children can sit here, you go fight and then come back later?
Because once they're initiating it and asking it, right, to begin with, people are going to say, what's motivating them? Okay? But once, what's it called, Moshe Rabbeinu offers it to them to begin with, we never asked for this. So if we were motivated because we're cowards, we would have come begging, right? Moshe already offered it, and we accepted it. No, but we didn't initiate it, right? If we initiated and we asked for it, then people can know what your motivation was. But if you have no motivation, you just came and explained the situation, and Moshe came up with this idea. It wasn't our idea. It was his idea. So then, what's it called? We can't say that we were motivated for this. We didn't even ask for that. We accepted it. Moshe suggested it. So obviously, it wasn't that we're dying not to die over there and to stay here. Because if we were, we would have begged for that. We didn't beg for it. We just came, right? Made clear what the situation was, and Moshe offered this. So if Moshe offered it, you can't say that we were motivated in a negative way. We didn't motivate anything. We accepted an offer that Moshe Rabbeinu made. That's what they hoped. Moshe said it won't help. If I offer it because you came and hinted, then people are still going to say, what motivated you to come bring about such an offer? I only offered it because you came, right, and hinted to this fact. So people still said the same thing. They understood that if it's not openly asked for, people will give them the benefit of the doubt. And Moshe said, you're misjudging people. People will still look for bad motivation if they know that you initiated this, even if you didn't ask for it openly. So you're not helping anything by not asking me openly. That was the Moshe said. On the other hand, what's it called? Once we went through this, and you're saying, no, that's not our intention. You're saying it openly, it's not your intention. And you're offering to go, not only to go fight, but to go fight in front of the people. That's enough to allay people's things. If you were to come like that to begin with, people say, oh, this is a nice ploy to, what's it called, to stay on this side of the yard. But once he went through, and Moshe Rabbeinu gave it to them, and they had to answer, no, that's not the case. Now people give them the benefit of the doubt. They said clearly, that's not the case. Had they come to begin with and said, look, we don't want it to look like we're cowards or whatever, then people said, that's exactly what's happening over here. That's why they have to, say, sometimes people say, it's not that, it's this. When they say it's not that, that's exactly what it is. So here, Moshe Rabbeinu says the only way to get around this is to make it clear how it looks, and that you're going to now answer and say that that's not exactly what your intentions were. But if you were to come to begin with this great plan, people would have said that you made up this plan only because you're cowards. Okay, there's another part over here. It says that the Negadim and the Reuven, because they chose not to settle in Eretz Yisrael, they settled in Transjordan and not in Eretz Yisrael proper. Therefore, when the Gullus came, the first Gullus, who were the first ones to be exiled? The Negadim and the Reuven. Right? What's it called? Sanhariv came and took the 10 tribes who were in what's it called, part of them were the first ones were B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven, and exiled them. So there's a little bit of a problem here, because exile means l'chora that you're going out of Eretz Israel, right? That's Galus. So if Transjordan was Galus already, it wasn't Eretz Israel, they can't go into Galus. They're in Galus. Unless it just means that now they were exiled from their land, right? But it's mashmam, when they went into Galus, they left Eretz Israel. But it wasn't Eretz Israel. One of Shem. If it's Eretz Israel, then they went into Galus. But if they went into Galus, then they lived in Eretz Israel. And the answer is that Transjordan has some laws like Eretz Israel and something not. It's not full Eretz Israel, but it's not Eretz Israel at all. There's certain things you can bring and have to do in Transjordan and Eber HaYarden that apply to Eretz Israel only and not to Chutz La'aretz. So in that respect, it's like Eretz Israel. But there are certain laws like Bikurim. You can't bring Bikurim from Eber HaYarden. So in that respect, it's like Chutz La'aretz. So in some respects, it's like, so they didn't live in Eretz Israel mamish, but they lived in a place that was not Chutz La'aretz either. It wasn't Eretz Israel, but it wasn't Chutz La'aretz. So it's possible to go in Galus from there to Chutz La'aretz. It's possible also not to be considered living in Eretz Israel, because for certain halachas, okay, in any case, it says that these people valued their money more, valued their money more than their children, because they said, we'll build corrals for our sheep and cities for our children. Moshe Rabbeinu changed it around. He said, first build a city for your children, then worry about your sheep. Right? Your children should be more important to you than your money. Okay? And the Medrash comments on this, that B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven had a wrong approach to money. Why? It says that money, right, osher, wealth, is a very important thing. The Gemara says, the Medrash says, there are three things. If you have any one of them, you have everything. One of them is chachma, wisdom. Second is osher, wealth. And the third is gvura, strength. If you're zocha to any one of them, you have everything. Strength and wealth and chachma. When is that? When it's a present from God. But if you grab it, then it's not a, what's it called? Not, you have nothing. So what does that mean, you grab it? It's possible to grab wealth and wisdom and gvura and not be present. Everything God gives. So obvious is, what do you think it is? If you understand that it's God-given, then you have everything. If you think that you grabbed it, then there's something wrong. What it means is the following. Wealth is a very, very important thing. You can use it for a tremendous mitzvah, for tremendous benefit. You can have when you're wealthy, you can have a life that enables you to learn Torah and do mitzvahs and give tzedakah and not be worried about having to go work very hard. You can have plenty of time to learn. It is a means to help your avodas Hashem. But if you grab it and you consider the wealth an end in itself, and even where it comes in conflict with avodas Hashem, you go after the wealth, then you don't consider that a present from God to enhance your avodas Hashem. You consider it something that is intrinsically valuable. And even if it comes in conflict with avodas Hashem, you're going to go after your wealth. That's wrong. Same thing with gvura, power. Right? Power you can use tremendously to serve Hashem with power, to make people do mitzvahs and to be influential on people or whatever. Right, that's a tremendous thing of power. If it's a means to reach an end, it's an enhancement, a means to serve Hashem with that power, then it's everything. You can do tremendous things with it. But if you think the power is an end in itself, and therefore even when it comes in conflict with Avodas Hashem, you're going to go after the power, then it's nothing. Same thing goes with money, with wealth. We just said wealth. With wisdom. If you look at a wisdom, you're a chacham or whatever, you can really advise people and you can function nicely yourself and know a lot of Torah and learn very easily or whatever. So if you're a chacham and you realize the chachma is there as a means to reach an end, and the end is avodas Hashem, and you use your chachma for avodas Hashem, it's everything. But if you think that it's an end in itself, you grab that as an end, as an end in itself, as a purpose in itself, and you'll use your chachma even against the Torah, Not when it furthers your avodas Hashem. You usually ask questions and to have doubts or whatever, because you're such a big chacham, you think that you know better than the chachamim, better than the Torah. Then your chacham is worth nothing. That's what it means. So therefore, b'nei Gad and b'nei Reuven, if they would have understood that their wealth is something to help them to be do avodas Hashem, they wouldn't have chosen because of their wealth to live outside of Eretz Yisrael. Because then it comes in conflict with Avodas Hashem. Living in Eretz Yisrael proper is for sure a bigger schos than living in Eivor HaYarden. And if I'm willing to forego a madrega and Avodas Hashem for my wealth, that means the wealth is not merely a means for Avodas Hashem, because it doesn't make any sense then to go after the wealth where it conflicts.